Watch your waiting for. Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in the ground. Fill your body up in. Work it hard and long. When you finish that.
Deep knocker.
Episode 230 of the Talking Bollocks podcast, brought to you by Go Loud and proudly supported by Roy Style Furniture.
Are you in the middle of turning your house into a home?
Get down to Roy Style Furniture, an Irish family-run spot that's actually sound. I won't sell you a couch that looks like it's had to be found in a skip.
The house package deals are unreal. Sofas, beds, dining sets, the full walks from just $3,649.
Plus, they're open 7 days a week and open late on Thursdays and Fridays in Fonthill and Omni. Handy if you're walking all day as well.
They're in Fonthill, Belgard and now Omni Park. I got my corner sofa off them and it's chef's kiss.
I'd live in that sofa, do you know that?
Sure, you'd have to call the fire brigade to get you over. Right price, right style, right now.
Visit www.roystyle.ie and use promo code GET10 for 10% off.
It's me, Terry Flower.
It's me, COB.
And this week we're joined by...
Ruth Barry.
Fuck me, I might have been panicking down that intro there. Jesus Christ. Ruth, what's the crack? How are you?
I'm good.
So the reason why I wanted him to do that, Ruth, was because you have something that you wanted to sting him with.
Oh, no. What is this now?
I don't know.
So the reason why I wanted to invite you into the Docus that week was they have caterpillars in there.
Oh, here we blink.
So is that why you didn't go, Terry? Is that why you didn't go?
I didn't see the invite. Apparently I was invited.
Yeah.
Up.
But we wanted to show you all
the caterpillars and all me delighted sitting there.
Itching.
Fuck's sake.
So there is caterpillars in there. They have little rearing containers. And the women look after the caterpillars.
Oh, you hate this podcast.
Until they turn into butterflies and lay eggs.
Oh, you hate this podcast. Do you know how long is this going on?
Not long enough. We're still going.
We still have guests coming in. Fucking hell. Ruth, anyways.
It is a true story, though. They do that as a rehabilitative thing.
Do they, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Why, what does that do?
It gives them patience, nurture, care, and it's a rehabilitative approach because they get to look after the caterpillar and then it lays eggs. They capture the eggs and then they release. So it's like... you're in a cocoon within the prison wall.
Yeah.
And then you're ready for transformation and then ready for
the symbolism of it all. Yeah, you can see. I can see what that
makes sense there.
Yeah.
You obviously do a bit of work up there.
Yeah, I do.
What do you do up there?
I do a lot of different things. Like, I started going in first, doing talks with the women. Now, we had a run in there, a 5K colour run that I was able to bring members from Inner City Running Club, that are guards and Department of Justice and a probation officer that was once my probation officer in there and now I run with her. A lived experience guy, Carl DeQuay. He works now in Mount Joy for Merchants Quay. And it was to get each one of them in order to show them that, like, it's a human-to-human connection. Mm. Maybe they might have arrested you or the probation officer you might not got on with. But like to show them that the connection and the tools of running and the echo of laughter and smiles. I never experienced it in there.
Mm.
And at the moment, the month of July and August in there is very high for violence and self-harm. There hasn't been one incident since all this was implemented. So this month, they're going to be doing a program and it's sports day. So kids that are in care and kids that have not seen their mother will do a sports day with the mother. So they allow me go in as a peer mentor. I do that voluntarily because the women trust me, they respect me, and they have that connection. I do different work, but I massively advocate. So I've been in Leinster House numerous times because of the overcrowding and because stuff is gender specific. So it wasn't designed for women. It's not designed for women that are pregnant and it's not designed for mothers.
Mm.
You know, you have to consider that when you're going to court, was there coercive control? Was there domestic violence? Was there sexual abuse? It's like 80% of the women in there have experienced, if not all, one of them.
So, Ruth, you're in doing all them bits and pieces there. There's a lot to what I understand. So it's going to be hard to get through everything that you're doing and advocating for at the minute. There's obviously a reason why you want to do that work. You said that you do it voluntarily as well, which is amazing. So fair play to you for that. But Give us a background on who you are, where you're from, what was life like growing up for you, and why you wanted to go on to do what you're doing now.
So, like, for example, my first memory is sitting in a high chair, 9 months old. Me dad having me mar on the floor, baiting the kitchen door off her face, blood everywhere. And that's my first memory. I grew up in a home with two sisters and two brothers. I was the middle child and the youngest girl. But I grew up with a lot of violence and alcoholism, and my both parents worked. So my sisters were kind of left a lot with us. Like, we were shown love, but beatings upon beatings, and I tended to get them more than the rest of them. Like, we'd be bouncing on the bed and my dad come up the stairs, bamboo stick, shoe, belt, and I'd protect me brother that was a bit younger than me and get it. Like, it just, I kind of spiraled out of control, and then I was 11 and my sister was 19. She was going out to work and she bent over and gave me a kiss as she was going. She was like, see you later, kiddo. Her and my ma had an argument over paint, the colour of paint in the hall going out the door. 10 minutes later, my dad comes in the van and goes back out. A few minutes later, my dad comes with his boss and I walked out with my mum, and they were hysterical at the door. She was after being killed by an articulated lorry, a bin man, dragged 150 metres down the road on a push bike. Her best friend and dad were in the car behind. My dad was 5 down, and he drove back because it clicked to him. That bike looked familiar. And when he came back, she was on the ground, like, top of her head, open. She was the one that kind of was always there for us, the one that nurtured us, gave us the love. Yet it would be a team, me and my other sister against her and my brother, like, but she was the ray of sunshine in our life. Our nickname was Sunshine. And the dynamics of our family just massively changed. My mum was 8 months pregnant at that time. That evening, all my family were there. I live in a three-story house in Ringsend. I tried to throw myself out the top window because life without her just didn't seem possible. And my auntie and my cousins pulled me back in, and I had to be monitored. And over the next while, like, we lived just near the East Link Bridge. Numerous times I had to be pulled out of the water by the lifeguards, or police rang and neighbours and my ma coming out looking for me, because I just couldn't cope. I wouldn't go to the family therapy. I used to sit in my bedroom and I'd put my feet up against the door, my back up against the radiator, and they couldn't get me out of the room. Like, because we were also told, don't tell them that your dad bet you, don't tell them this, don't tell them that. You know, everything was a secret. We weren't allowed to tell anyone anything, but yet they wanted you to go to therapy and discuss family life. So I didn't want to go because I wouldn't have held in. And I became so angry. My mom and dad split up not long after that. And then, like, I kind of became chaotic, start hanging around in sides and going to sides and selling bogey ears, buying Rubik's and nail bite, you know, that nail biting thing to rub on it, and selling bogey ears outside raves and bunking into the raves, and just got caught up with different people and used to climb out the window and sneak out, but I wasn't even missed half of the time. And then being in around town then led me kind of to Sheriff Street and different areas like that. And I got caught up in crime and caught up in many different things over the years. And then I met my oldest two's father. And I kind of got caught in heroin.
How old are you when you start trying heroin?
Probably about, I think, 17. And I tried it once or twice. But then I kind of didn't get strung out on it until after I had my first. I had her at 20. But I had tried ears, and I did try it a few times. We used to take it in the broken down flats in Sheriff Street. And I took it a few times. But it was to be accepted. it was because they were all doing it and I just thought it was the in thing. And little did I know that one day I'd wake up and addiction was in me blood, riddled in me bones and the aches and pains. And but in a way, I felt like it suppressed all that pain. It suppressed everything that I had, the abuse, the abandonment, rejection, and the feeling of not being loved by your parents. Like, it just, I suppose, that numbed everything for me. And my mum then fucked me out. I'm a little course.
Yeah, you can walk away.
Like, she, guards came in one day and I was in the bathroom getting washed and they were booting the door in the bathroom to get me out. Like, my daughter was just over a year at the time. And I was actually just at the getting on Amy Street clinic. So I was a bit more balanced and I'd nowhere to go. Nowhere. The first night I actually came back and slept in our porch with the child. And then there was multiple times where I actually climbed in abandoned buildings were and stayed down on the docks on the quays. So I went from hostel to hostel. I often left my daughter with different family and his family and slept in his mum's shed out in the back garden with a blanket in the middle of winter. Because back then, homelessness wasn't the way it was now. You had to ring the night bus and you had to get on a bus and they'd drive you here, there and everywhere. You didn't know where you were going. You didn't even know if you had a bed that night. And there was some nights they say, no, sorry, we're full, but I have a baby. And what? That's not our problem. But they've a bit more compassion and empathy now. And I suppose they have hotels and B&Bs where it wasn't that available back then. Then, like, I got caught up in more crime. And then after that, I got a place in East Wall and I just started getting bad on cocaine, worse on heroin. And I just kept trying to get out of that relationship. And then it ended up, I did get out of it, but I was 2 months pregnant on my second. And I went out with this lad when I was a teenager, when I first came to Sheriff Street. And I ended up getting back with him. And then I had my second child. And then I was kind of dipping in and out, still on my methadone program, but still quite chaotic and angry. And, you know, you'd have Tulsa involved as well because yeah. Your clinic mm-hmm. then reported you. Like, I'm not proud to say this, but I often brought my kids up in a pram in town and filled the pram with stuff, like, in order to feed a drug habit. I put that drug in front of everything, including my children. And my trauma is now their trauma. But that's something that I accept. You know, what I done in life was put down onto them. And that's something that they have to deal with now in life. I had a tour with my then partner. And after a few hours, I turned around and he was blue in the cot beside me. I picked him up and brought him screaming out to the nurse. And they brought him up to ICU. It felt like hours. It just felt like hours. They didn't let me know because they treated you different when you were on drugs. And then they came down, they said, like, he's in ICU, like, he's hooked up to different machines. Don't get a fright when you go up. And so he ended up, after weeks, being diagnosed with 3 different ailments, all respiratory stuff. So he was in hospital for a long period of time. His dad actually got sentenced in prison at the time. And the nun actually brought him out to see him into the ICU. And he was like, I'm just going down the shop to get her a drink. And he legged it. He legged it. Like, and the police then went looking down Sheriff Street for him. He went straight down to Sheriff Street. Like, he fucking legged it. Like, coming to see a child and you do a runner. Like, hey, yeah, you know, I nearly died. Like, but I'm fucking off. Like, and he was found hiding under a garden chair street back up. He ended up getting out then in a few weeks' time. And we had a great relationship, like a great relationship. And I was at the getting stable and I was just on the methadone. But he was taking heroin. And on Stephen's estate, he was like, oh, I'm in bits. And I wouldn't allow it in the house at that time because I was at the getting stable, like, and because I told to involved as well, like, and his friend came over in a taxi, picked him up and brought him over. Stephen's day. Yeah, it was Stephen's day because it was his birthday. And my brother was at the buying a house and he was having a housewarming and I went out. On the way back, I got a phone call. He was at the being shot in the head, asleep on the sofa. I just thought, I jumped out of the car on the keys and ran around with the child in my hand. And his brothers were at the climbing over the wall to get in. And I could just see his feet on the sofa. The guards wouldn't let us in, like. And it was breaking point for me. You know, that he had nothing to do with any of this. And his life was taken. And he'd only a newborn son. And the fact that my son never got to know him. And it was like everything just fell apart then again. And I got into addiction and it went downhill. And one day I went to collect my kids and Tulsa had took the boys out of the creche. But I had to go to the school and take my daughter and hand her to the police and a social worker on the corner of Sheriff Street. And it killed me. I just wanted to run. But 3 weeks later, I got them back. But they were put with strangers. They were broken up and put with strangers. And that's something that I had to really do a lot of work on, was forgiving myself for putting them through that. And then after a few years, I met someone else. And I just got deeper and deeper. Crack, cocaine, heroin, anything I could get my hands on, like. And I suppose I'd done things I'm not proud of. I fell pregnant again. But this time, my little girl Ellie passed. And I didn't handle that well. I just got so angry at the world that how could an innocent child be taken from me? Now I see it differently. She would have ended up in care and my family wouldn't have been able to take her. You know, in life now I see it as it's not happening to me, it's happening for me. But that broke me and I ended up in a fight on O'Connell Street and assaulting people. And through that, I ended up getting a very heavy charge. And I got a 7-year sentence with 18 months suspended, so 5.5 to do. And like, I ended up in prison.
Such a first time in prison?
I went to prison in the old Mountjoy. I was in there for 2 weeks. And then I got custody once or twice, but that was my first sentence.
What was that like for you getting sentenced?
I knew it was coming. But I think because it was so public, that the shame of it, the guilt, and how it impacted my children and my family. Like, and then how they'd have to cope without me being around. Like, a few minutes call, a few times a week, a visit once a week. It was, I suppose, the fear of going in there. But being an addict at the time, I well prepped myself going in there. Like, no, without saying that.
Yeah.
Like, a turkey was stuffed, just say.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that in some of the talks because that is the reality.
Yeah.
Of,
yeah.
You know, that is the reality of things. People bring, because I didn't want to have to deal with the first few nights in there and accept I'm here for a long time, you know. So I don't remember my first few weeks in there, in fairness. I don't. And the officers actually thought it was some that I was handicapped because, sorry for saying this, but like I kept like this over the bushes and falling asleep on things and I was very slow. And but when the drugs wore off, they seen a different person. But my first night in there, I sobbed. I sobbed my heart out and I thought, like, is this what my kids are like at home? are they feeling the way I'm feeling? Because we had to hide papers. We had to hide, like, kids nowadays only have to Google things. And everything was a secret. And my older daughter knew, but the other two didn't. It was a few weeks before I got to see them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was hard, knowing that they had to come there. I couldn't touch them on a visit. Couldn't give them a hug. Or, like, sometimes it could be a 15, 20 minute visit that you're trying to spread out between three children and your mother, like. So it was very hard to adapt because I was shared in rooms and people are coming and going. And, like, I was like, I need a cell to myself. Like, I'm doing a longer sentence, but you have to work and behave in order to get these. But I wasn't. I was thrown up at the nets. I was fighting because it's like you have to shroud yourself in armor of toughness in order to say, like, don't mess with me, don't bully me, you know. And that's what I felt I needed to do. Because I brought drugs into the prison, people were all over you and trying to, you know, fight you to take your drugs and things like that. So it was like I had to have this armor on. And I was constantly getting into trouble. And through that, I ended up getting sent to Limerick prison for a month as punishment. So that was like the men's prison. Like, there was lockback and all. There is now in the women's. That wasn't there when I was there. That only started through COVID.
What is that?
Lockback.
Yeah.
So, like, previously, I'd get out at 8 o'clock in the morning and then it'd be 7, 8 o'clock. You'd get lockback in the evening. So now you get out, you get your breakfast, lockback, you know.
So, like, your cell is basically open all day. You're out for the day and then you go back at night.
Yeah, but that's not the case now.
Yeah.
So they go back for meals and then they come back out and they're able to go out to school or to work and things like that. But then when the drugs wore off, I was like, I need to cop on. I can't be sitting around tables and throwing up at net. Like, I need to come off this methadone. This is my one opportunity to turn my life around and to never come back here and get out of addiction. I always said, if I got the opportunity to go to treatment, I'd take it with both hands. So I start going to school. I start educating myself, doing the sports and fitness, working the gym out of it. And I ended up coming out of small yard into different houses, around into the big yard and up into the trustee unit, like, with a lot of work. Like,
sorry, Ruth, just if you want to explain that to people, the way the prison system works, it's like they progress you onto, like, lesser security, isn't it? It's like a progress system, basically, isn't it?
Yeah, it's progression. So there's different regimes. There's basic, standard and enhanced. So if you're on basic, you're realistically in the small yard because you're getting into trouble and you're problematic. So people that are on enhanced are normally people engaging in the school that are on good behaviour and that are either working and stuff like that. But there's different houses for different kind of regimes. And then there's Willows for people that who are doing really, really well. And, like, you don't get locked back at all. So you have your key card to go up into the Willows. And, like, the rooms are massive, like. So you have a lot more privileges up there. And generally, a lot of people that are in, well, when I was there, would be the ones that are getting, you know, days out as well, like. But you have to work your arse off in order to get to that point. But, like, people call the Dokas a holiday camp. It's not. It's far from it. Like, you see things in there that, you know, are also traumatic. It's a place where you don't get to hug your kids. It's a place that a lot of women are extremely broken, mentally on the floor. But prison saved my life. People don't often say that. I'm grateful that I went there. And I have so much gratitude for a lot of the officers that were there, that, and the governor at the time, Mary O'Connor, who helped me with rebuilding relationships with my kids and facilitated different visits. Like, I, after a long period of time, would get out into the visiting center when all the visits were open to spend 2 hours with my kids.
Mm.
Because there's so many prisoners, you're only getting small bits of time in that window. of the visiting hours, you're not getting to have that relationship with your kids. You're like missing key points in their life when they're going through the first period. Like for a girl to not have a mother there to getting awards in schools or winning football matches, you miss out on all that. Like what holiday camp is that for a child as well? Like it's key moments in their life that you can never get back.
Mm.
Like my kids became a product of my environment. And now they like have to seek therapy because of what my journey inflicted on them. And that was hard to take. It was hard, but in prison, you have a lot of time to sit with yourself. Like I had a lot of conditions on me. I had to do anger management because I was aggressive. I was a little bastard in fairness. Like you come at me and I'd put you on your back in a second. And thankfully today, I'm not that person. Thankfully through doing anger management, doing counselling and that, having the right supports where support and connection is vital for people to transform and have growth. But I was able to sit in the silence and ask myself, why did I do these things? Like there was a lot of my childhood that was just blank. I didn't remember. But sitting in silence in a cell in there, I was able to revisit moments and understand why I was who I was. And understand that my parents had their trauma and that generational cycle passed on and then passed on. But my youngest, it's not.
Mm.
I swore that that would break, that she wouldn't have to go through any of the things that my kids endured. Like, no child should have to go through it. And I understand that today. But I let the addiction control me instead of being able to control it.
Ruth, you said about when you were in prison, you went to school and you went on this progressive journey. Where was your drug use at? Where was your addiction at when you're going on that journey in prison?
So I started doing the gym and doing the school when I was coming off the methadone because I was like, I feared coming off the methadone. And as I said earlier, like I used it as a crutch. But I was like, oh, I'm going to have pains, I'm going to have aches. So I rewired my mindset coming off that methadone and went to the gym, running on a treadmill. Oh, this is lactic acid buildup. Oh, my legs are hurting because I lifted a weight and rewired it. And yeah, I was under the influence of methadone. But like sometimes you're not getting a stone out of methadone. Like it's just making you feel normal. So then, like, I didn't go over once or twice and give me urine, so I got deducted 10 mil. So I was like, I'm not going back, like, to give the urine the following week to get put back up. So I'd done that twice. And then they were like, do you want to get put back up? And I was like, after a week of coming down off it, no, thanks. And I slowly came over and off it while I was engaging in school. But like there would have been times I was in the school and I was literally head on the table falling asleep. But I don't reduce the use with sale in there. I don't like alternative to violence. And I also done, I was the first one to do the restorative practice in the pilot program. And that was a turning point for me as well. But yeah, I suppose I came off my methadone while I was doing the gym and then pushed for a gym a health and fitness course to be brought in, and they did bring it in. So I engaged with that, and just so they give you still not for 2 weeks after you come off your methadone. I refused to take it. Like I literally went over 2 days and got a spoon with like 3 mils on it, and I was like, why am I even doing that?
Yeah,
it was a force of habit,
yeah,
of 15 years of going to clinics that you depended on something daily. So I was going over there every day to get that into healthcare and queuing, and like I was like, no, that's actually embarrassing going and like licking a spoon to get fucking 3 mils off. Like,
yeah.
So I just stopped then and I never went back then and just engaged fully in school, got a job in there in the kitchen and done different things, painting, cleaning, done hairdressing in the any course that became pyrography, woodburning, leather work, English, like leaving certain things, like anything.
And were you doing all these things on purpose to occupy your brain more? Or were you doing all these because you just wanted to keep learning? Or were you conscious that?
Well, knowledge is power.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So I wanted to engage myself fully in the school because you don't want to be sitting idle in yourself.
Yeah.
Because that's when...
thoughts creep in and...
But if you're not engaging in school, also you're put back down to... Even if you engage once or twice, but like I was in the morning, in the afternoon, gym in the evening, the gym just and the running just became my freedom. You know, I didn't feel like I was behind the prison walls. I just felt I could deal with things better. That anger, that tension slowly left my body through being able to have movement in there. So like I fully immersed myself into education in there. And I think it's important for every one of them. Like you will have people that are dyslexic. You will have people that don't read and write, but they cater for all different levels in there. And the teachers, like they're not prison staff. So the teachers come in and they've so much compassion and empathy and love for what they do. And there's some really amazing programs in there, but there's not enough. And a lot of the programs were catered for gender specific, for males.
Yeah.
So now they're trying to bring other programs into the prison. And like you will have a high engagement with the education in there. Like you do. And then you have others that work. They have a barista course in there now. And like when I go in or there's different engagements in there, they have like a coffee cart. And they actually have now created Docus Inc. And they make their own cupcakes and cookies and pastries and stuff like that. Like, so there is amazing things happening in there. Like, just because people are in there and they've committed a crime doesn't mean they are that crime, like, for the rest of their life.
Well, there's one thing about you, Ruth, where I'm sitting here. You haven't held back on anything in terms of you're so open about things you've done, the shame and everything that you're at the speaking about. But the way you're speaking about prison, it seems to have changed your whole mindset. And the things that you went on to do in prison seems to have changed your mindset forever nearly.
I never want to go back there. I was a kleptomaniac. Like I couldn't go in a shop and not take some. Do you know what I mean? Like we'd be running into Arnott's, running out of bags with the bugs on them, running into Dorset Street Flats and Dominic Street Flats, hiding on the security guards and everything. Like, I just couldn't pass a shop without taking anything. And in there gave me a chance to work on my behaviours, my habits, the reasons why I offended, and work on not re-offending anymore. But there was a major turning point reason also. It wasn't just the prison, it was something that also happened, and that was the pregnancy of my daughter. Just a little more. I was getting out on weekends, and my partner at the time, who was my co-accused, had been released. Wasn't in my TR form not to have sex, but I did. And like,
okay. It's stay away from Lois's premises. It didn't say stay off your back.
It doesn't, and they don't offer contraceptives. So, they were fucked.
They're strict.
Yeah.
I know someone who went to TR and said, like, can't be on the licensed premises. I was like, what, have you got to a restaurant that serves drink?
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I'm kidding. You have to leave.
Yeah. So I came back to the prison pregnant.
Sorry, Ruth, how far into your sentence are you when this is happening? When you're getting out?
Like nearly 3 years.
So it's not an immediate thing?
No. So I hid it. So I was 3 months pregnant. And I hid it and I confided in a girl in there. And like she didn't open her mouth. And so I was able to share that with her. I've had a few miscarriages. And then I had my little girl that was stillborn. and I start bleeding, I panicked. And I was like, what on earth do I do? Like, what do I do here? How do I tell these I'm pregnant? So I went over to an officer that I really got on with. And she said, look, I'll ring the governor now, and went into healthcare. It was a while before I actually got in. And I was chastised over that, like a scolded child. So I was brought to the hospital. This was in the evening time, by two officers, a male and a female. And within a few hours, it was all over the newspapers.
Is that why you hit her?
No, it wasn't. It was the fear of the punishment of, like, it hasn't happened that a woman come back to the prison pregnant. Yet many males get out and impregnate their wives, but it doesn't happen in the women's. So my mom rang the prison. That's how she found out. And my daughter, I never forget, she was in the Gael Tocht, and she found out that my mom said, I don't want anything to do with you ever again. Your kids are in my care, and you can't even look after the ones you have, and you're having another one. So my family broke away from me. The officers changed with me because it put the media onto the prison then. But even the highlight, she got pregnant on an overnight, but then highlighted your case. You know, it doesn't even highlight more about the pregnancy. It went back into your background. So there was so much shame and guilt then of, like, is me ma right? Like, I'm having a baby and me other kids are there. And then I was getting out on community return. I was going to college. That was all taken away. I was punished for being pregnant. And it got to the stage where I was like, I don't even want this baby. And I know it's horrible to say that, but I just felt like as if everything was gone from me that I'd worked so hard for. I wasn't allowed, the father of the child, go to hospital appointments. I had to do it all on my own. Thinking of it now, the fact that I hated being pregnant. And that child is the one that has given me life and given me a purpose and saved me, that I could even consider thinking that of her. But I just felt as if everything was being wiped from under me. Like, I'm getting out these gates and now I can't because I'm pregnant. So I got onto them and I was like, how can you punish me for this when, like, I didn't break or breach any TR? And I got onto my solicitor, and then my solicitor ended up getting on them. So I, for a long time, I was visiting the breast clinic because I had a lump. I used to go to that on my own, them appointments on my own. In the beginning, it was with an officer. I was brought then to appointments with Ella by the officers when I used to go to appointments. So everything changed. My days out stopped. My weekends stopped. And then I didn't have my family coming up to visit. So I became so depressed. And when you're pregnant, you're quite vulnerable. Your hormones are all over the place. I disengaged from the school. I'd go out to the gym. But because my previous history with miscarriage and stillbirth, I kind of steered away from it slightly. And I became the talk of the prison, you know. So everything in there is like under a microscope. Everybody knows everything. And it made my sentence become tough and the days became longer. And I was taken down from the trustee unit and then put into the mother and baby unit. So like it was like the walk of shame, carrying all your stuff down back into the yard with people. After a while, because I had experienced no fetal movement, I used to get brought to the hospital twice a day. So once in the morning for scans and then in the morning for traces, 2-hour trace and then scans. They hadn't got the staff to bring me there. But then they put on my TR form, has not to have father of child in the hospital, has not to meet the father of the child. I used to take money out of my grant or money that I had saved up to get food when I went out. So I was gone out from 9 o'clock till 3. I wasn't even allowed to take money out. They got so strict and severe. So fast forward a little bit, kind of coming up to the end of the pregnancy, I told them that I wasn't bringing the baby back to the prison, that I wasn't having her in there with sex offenders that had done things to their own kids, that I couldn't protect her in that environment. in a hostile environment, or I can't protect her when I'm sitting down and they sit facing you in a dining hall. I didn't want her there. And I didn't want the fact that I had my first at home in a bathroom. I thought I was having fucking crap. Like, in fairness, like, and I had her nearly going down the toilet. My longest birth was 20 minutes. So I kept telling them, I'll go early and I'll have her quick. And they were like, every pregnancy is different. I was like, no, seriously, all mine have been the same. And they were like, no, mother needs to be with the baby. I was like, no, she's not coming back here. She's not. I'm just not. Because if I had had her in the prison, like I went into early labor and it was quick, her address would have been the docus for the rest of her life.
If you're on the birth cert.
Yeah. So like, why would I inflict something like that on a child?
It's the women that have babies in the docus.
There's two babies in there at the moment.
But like, do they give birth in there? I mean, or do they, what way does
no,
that
work? No, they get rushed out to the hospital. But like, it has happened previously that people can have babies within prison. There was one in UK recently and they didn't get in time and baby passed and died. Like, you know, so there isn't an in-house midwife. And this is something that I would love to happen, because I think it's vital that if anything happens or if they have questions, that they have that midwife that can explain in detail, well, this is why this is happening and this is why you're feeling this way. Not have to wait for an appointment a month or two down the line. Yeah, you have healthcare there, but they're not midwives.
So what way does it work if there's a woman serving a sentence and she's pregnant, she rushes off, she gives birth, the mother and the baby just go back into the prison then?
Yeah, they, like, if you're on methadone or if you have a previous history of drugs, you'll stay in the hospital for 5 days and then, or a certain amount, 124 hours or whatever it is, and then you go back to the prison with the baby as normal, into the mother and baby. But they have now took the mothers and baby out, the mother and baby, and are now in the cells. So you'd have bunk beds and then you would have a small gap and then you have a cot.
And like, what's the long-term plan then?
After 12 months, the baby goes.
So that child is like remembering that. That child is like learning how to walk in prison.
Yeah. First words, first tooth, first crawl. But then the traumatic events then of separation, because if the mother's doing a few years, for the mother and for the child, does the child go into state care then? Or is there family? And these are things that are also getting looked at the moment. Like, but it's also, you can't be a proper mother because you're dictated to, like, if you have your child in the bed beside you. Like, all my kids slept in the bed with me. Every one of them. But I suppose they have a health and safety thing.
Procedure, like, this might sound like a stupid question as well, but is there a possibility that two women could be shared in a cell and one of them has a baby?
Yeah.
That's, like, in 2025, that doesn't...
So at the moment, maximum capacity is 146. We've hit over 200 in the last few days. And that's not... The babies aren't registered on that. So that's mattress on floors. You have three to a cell in some of them. The women's prison is the highest in overcrowding, both Limerick and both the Docus. They're the highest. I was just blessed that I got out 13 days before I had my baby. December the 14th. But no money, no pram, put into homeless accommodation with bars on the windows in Summerhill. And that was part of my condition, was to go there. I actually cried when I was brought down. Please bring me back, please bring me back. Like, it was damp and it was so overwhelming, like, because I literally found out last minute. I was excited that I wasn't having her in the prison, like, but to where I went, I could have went to a family home, but I suppose they felt that I might have needed supported housing, but realistically I didn't. I was able to do everything for myself, like, and that's the issue at the moment. At the moment, women are getting put out onto the street from the prison.
Is there open prisons for women?
No. And it's something that we're pushing for at the moment as well. So I'm on Penal Reform International as well. I actually sit on one of the committees for Department of Justice, and I'm on the probation advisory panel for creating roles with people with lived experience. And a lot of these key factors are being highlighted at the moment to be looked at. And I brought it up in Leinster House. We need a step down house for women. like even a women's detention house or an open prison. But I suppose you keep getting hit back with it's different for women, because what if the men that have been domestically abusing them turn up at the open prison? But what if the women that are domestically abusing the men turn up at the men's open prison? You know?
What if anyone turns up at an open prison though?
Yeah.
Like what if, I don't know, Terrence fucking murdered my, or assaulted someone in my family. No, but like, you know, like, let's say you done something bad on like my family and I found out you were going to an open prison, what's to stop me showing up at the open prison? You know what I mean? If that's your...
Yeah, well, there's still a way into it, like, you know, that's your argument. Still security,
yeah. So then...
But it's just a bad argument on their end.
Yeah, that's
what the security is for.
Yeah.
If the partner who was abused is not going to show up, that's what you have security for.
Yeah. And at the moment, they want to build more prisons. And for me, I don't think that's the answer. You know, like, if you bring in tagging, or if you have community sanctions, so different community programs. So at the moment... One of your prior guests, Craig O'Brien. So I am trying to get something off the ground with Craig to have different things like this and different interventions for youth so they don't go to prison. And I was at a roundtable meeting there recently with the Irish Penal Reform Trust. And this was about looking at women and mothers and sentences from 12 months down. So like if you're going into prison and you're getting 12 months and you're sometimes you could be out in a week if the numbers are high, like you're back in a week later. So me going in there, some of the women that were in there when I was there have been back in 100 times.
Yeah.
What are we doing to rehabilitate these women? There is different programs, but they're not all collectively coming together. They're competing against each other to get into these prisons or get into different environments. Join the dots and bring them together and collaborate, you know, because these are people's lives that you're talking about. Very vulnerable and marginalized people in society that deserve to have these opportunities. Like, if I can turn my life around, every, not just women, every man, woman in them prisons have that potential to do that. Like even in the men's prison studio today in Clover Hill, because it's a remand centre, there's not many programs within that. They were begging me to get a running thing in there the other day or other different programs like the trauma talks and all. They can't cater for that because they're on remand. They could be out in 4 weeks, but there is people that are in there 2 and 3 years on remand. You know, why are we not catering for these? I think because there's so much stigma attached and judgment on people that commit crime. But like sometimes you have to look beyond the crime that they committed 15 years ago. Like I haven't been in trouble in 15 years, like, but yet I still face barriers. Like I had someone recently use against me that I have convictions and that I was in addiction. Look on my social media. You can blame, obviously see that. You know, I'm very open about it, but yes, you're still facing barriers. In employment, in different areas in life, even down to athletics and running. And that's why the community-based running clubs are so important, because they don't see you like that. You know, and the likes of Inner City and there's another, Your Helpful Runners.
Yeah.
So like, they are just so inclusive to everyone. And there's so many people that are in recovery that go to this. And they're welcomed with open arms. But like, I faced things where, like, I'm a coach from Athletics Ireland and I had to go in front of them when they found out that I had convictions and they were banning me. And lucky that I could articulate and speak up for myself and that I also had people that backed me, the IPS, the Irish Prison Service, done me a brilliant letter, family base from Ballyferma. I was with Kenneth O'Driscoll at the time. And like, you might get a prison sentence, but you're doing a life sentence coming out because it follows you for the rest of your life. No matter what, even when you're doing well, in the newspaper we'll be like, ex-prisoner, former addict, blah, 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 done X, Y, and Z. Like, we're not our past. Like, people deserve those chances. And even the people that are in there, I'm not saying everyone, there is different crimes, but like, people do deserve to be able to turn their life around. And there's so many, like, I'm part of a program that I co-designed and actually facilitated, and James Leonard from the Two Norries. So him and his wife, and it's laid. It's the first of its kind, north and south of the border. So we had like turnaround project, Michael McCusker in Belfast, and Spiranua, Damien Quinn. But there was a few different people, Jerry Redmond, and like we facilitated it. But like every one of us, our lived experience, formerly incarcerated people that were able to develop, facilitate, co-design a program and have 16 participants graduate. You know, so it just goes to show, like, I sit and help with strategies, bail policies, and now sit on a committee of the Department of Justice. So if I can do that, anybody can do that.
Yeah.
Like, they can, like, it's possible. Just because, like, I got thrown out of school before my junior cert. I done my junior cert in the FOSS. I educated myself further in prison, but I always read. Like, just because you don't have an education doesn't mean you can't go on to do things in life. Mm. Like, I went on to Crumlin College on 2 years sports, fitness and nutrition. I now work with Dublin City Council, NEIC. Well, numerous different things I do, but, like, it's possible for any of us to go out and do it, like.
That's why we wanted your arm out as well, because, obviously, like you just said there a minute ago, you don't have to live in the past. Like, you can change, you can move forward. And I love what you said as well. Everybody has the potential then. Not everyone's going to go on and change. No. Everybody has the potential to change. And you're living proof of that.
But we don't often look at the patterns and the behaviours. And, like, people fear sitting with themselves and doing that work. Like, and I've further done that work. I've done mindset stuff with Jen. And even though I've done it over the years, I've learned a lot about myself through doing it with her. And part of my work that I done with her was to get back into the goals that you set, to get back in and help the women. Because I see their potential. You know, sitting, talking to them when they get stable within the prison. Like, what do you want to be? What's your purpose in life? And what do you love doing? Well, try do that in here. You know, I see past their crimes, and through some of the people that I've worked with in justice and in probation, I've actually changed their perspective on how they see people that commit crime. I've learned so much from them, but they've also gained so much from me and other people in the lived experience, because, like, you are seen as a down and out, but through the work you do and how you articulate yourself, how you show up in rooms, and, like, I was never confident enough to put myself out there. I was doing this work for years behind the scenes. It's only since January of working and not being afraid to put myself. I was terrified because of the stigma and how it would impact my children. But I asked my oldest daughter, was it okay? And, like, she was like, yeah, but this is the work I do. This is who I am. And people need to see that there's so many people like me, but women at the moment won't put themselves out there, because mothers shouldn't be going out and committing crime. Mothers shouldn't be in addiction. And that's what you're faced with. But I had to slowly learn that the opinions of others aren't a reflection of me. And what they project out there isn't on me. I've come to terms and I've done a lot of forgiveness work, forgiving what I've done, forgiving what was done to me, and accepted for who I was and who I am now. Like, even sitting here today, when I talk about some of my stuff and who I was, I'm like, I don't even recognise who that person is anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, I wouldn't even know her if she sat beside me, because I'm worlds apart from that person. And there's so much growth, like, and I'm constantly learning and constantly doing courses. And it's also who you surround yourself with. Support is vital. It's a vital thing for people in addiction, people in prison, because that connection can be whether you come out that gate and go and get a bag of gear, or it can be that you're going and you're going to meet Terrence or Ruth or Jer or Calvin and connect with them. So, like, there's been so many different changes within the prison. We have Adele McSorley. I don't know if you know her. She is Mr. Price, Miss Boss Woman, we call her. So she goes into the prison, she does the interview, and now she has people that have actually been in prison for stealing a Mr. Price. now working in Mr. Price, she takes people on with convictions and her staff mentor them and they have a whole wraparound service. And that's what on the committee for the Department of Justice we're trying to do as well. We're trying to get employers involved to take the chance on people because it's important. I don't know if you know Hope on Buckingham Street. It was hands-on peer education. That's where I first got my job. Irene took a chance on me and that. And had belief in me and actually kind of nurtured me and mentored me. And through her, I ended up getting the job with NAIC DCC. Like, so sometimes you have to have people like that that will take that chance on you.
It's a conversation that we had with Eddie Mullins. When we had, Eddie Mullins was the governor of Mountjoy for a while.
I know Eddie Mullins, brilliant.
I was saying that was part of the conversation that we had with him that was about after prison, trying to get work and speaking about, you were chatting to employers and stuff like that, yeah, trying to get people work after prison. It was a conversation that you had with Eddie. And
yeah, and even I remember years back when Lynn was talking about the spent convictions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that.
Mm. So I actually spoke to Lynn recently about helping her further in that because, like, if you have 10 shoplifting convictions, only one of them gets taken off. Like, there's so many different things put into that that it actually doesn't benefit anyone. So it needs to change because, like with me not being in trouble in 15 years, I go for a job, everything comes up.
Yeah.
From the 80s and the 90s, everything. You know, what job is going to take it on with, holy Jesus,
yeah,
a list of that? You know, and there's people that have a hell of a lot more than me. And you're either going into construction or you're going back into the addiction services. And that's what people feel that they have to do constantly, that you can only do them jobs. Or a lot of people in lived experience, like myself, are sole traders, are social entrepreneurs that have different outlets. And that's what you feel that you need to do. Like,
before we started, Ruth, you were saying you've done a lot of work on yourself over the last few years. And I think it really rings true. You're so articulate. You tell your story so well and so in detail, and I can even see it, like, you're taking your time with it. You don't want to rush through it. And I feel like you've told the story 1,000 times, but I feel like I'm watching the film, if that makes sense. You're able to describe it so vividly.
So what I have shared with you today, a lot of this I haven't shared previously. I think when you do a lot of work, you don't attach that emotion to it anymore, and you're able to articulate it, you're able to discuss it. But the reason why I had to pause a few times and slow down is because sometimes when you talk about stuff, that emotion does come.
Mm.
And especially when I talk about my little girl, because she's the one, even though I have four great kids, she's the one that has me changing my life and transforming. Everything I do in life, I do for her, to give her a home, to give her a different way of life, to give her love and not experience what I did as a child or what I inflicted and impacted on my children. I will never go back to prison and leave her, or that she has to be reared by someone else, because she's my safety blanket now. Like, I don't do NA. Loads of my friends do it. She's my NA. She's my God. She's my saving grace. She made me see motherhood differently. And the love that she reciprocates is just priceless, and we get to run together and I love it. Like, she's in athletics and she competes, but she absolutely, I don't know, through sport we have developed this unbreakable bond. Like, and I'm a solo parent, so I rear her completely on my own and do all this. I don't hide anything from Ella. She knows that I was pregnant and I'm in prison. She knows I was in addiction, because kids can be cruel and social media is so freely used that if you type in your name, she will know. So I have already prepared her if that ever does happen, but she does always say, "Mammy, do you know what? I'm so proud of you that that's the way you are and who you are now." Like, and she has been at, like, some of the talks that I do, and she loves it. Like, she's real outgoing, and she has saved my life more times than she can ever possibly imagine. Like, I wanted to take my life in prison. after I found out that my family weren't talking to me after I found out it was made public. And that's the thing. So many women tried to in the middle of the night, and we're all banging on the shutters to try and get them help. And you just feel so helpless that there's nothing that you can do. And that's one of the reasons why I advocate so much for the women, because I don't want them to live that life anymore. I want them to see what I see in them. That little girl that once had hopes and dreams, that they're not just diminished anymore. Because as a kid, we have all these, I suppose, little fantasies of what you want to grow up into, and they can still live that. And I'll continue advocating for them to the best of my ability. I won't stop until more rehabilitative stuff is brought in for them.
You said you and your daughter do running together. How did that start?
So my dad passed. I didn't talk to my dad for 20 years. And when I got out from an overnight from prison, I had done a lot of work. I rang him and I told him I forgived him. He told me he loved me and so forth. And then I had heard on the overnight that he had cancer and stuff like that. But I got to spend a few years with him before he died. I moved into Ballyferma 2-3 weeks after he died. I got a house up there. My brother and his wife live around the corner from me. And I isolated myself in the house. They were like, there's a club up the road, Cherry Orchard Running Club. Ken O'Driscoll go up. My uncle's in it. And I was like, oh no, I don't know anyone. This is your way of getting to know people in the area. So they brought me up, and that's how I got into it. One of the members actually gave me a running buggy, and I used to have her in the buggy. And then she started getting out and running 50 metres and then jumping back in and then running 100 metres and jumping back in. And then, like, at 5 years of age, she actually went and ran 10K for a little boy in a wheelchair and raised a lot of money for a little boy. Now she's never, I don't let her run that distance. That was a once off. And then she got into the Nor Harriers, and she just excelled from there. So she done the kids race in our city there on the bank holiday weekend. She was first girl, second. And then she done the 5K the next day with me. She absolutely loves it. She loves it. Like, she often does the session. She's done the sessions with in our city a few times. And she just loves the connection. Like, I'm very blessed that I get to run with her. That she actually, this is embarrassing now. When I'm doing my tempo sessions for my 400s, she actually paces me. Like, that's not funny, Darren. It's like your 9.5-year-old child pacing. Like, like her fastest 1K was 3.
Don't. That's all it down.
Yeah, that's enough. Don't even finish that.
Yeah, just leave her at that.
Yeah, so she won a race, and it was that year. So, like, I suppose, like, her training age would be nearly the same as some adults.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, getting into running. But it's also teaching her different things in life.
It's discipline as well.
Yeah, but you come across, like, sometimes she'd be running beside me and she'd say, oh, man, I'm struggling.
Yeah.
And I do say, Ella, you're going to come across struggles in life. You have to sometimes push through this to come out the other side. And I do say, find the comfort in your discomfort. And like sometimes she'd be going up a hill and she's like, she has an invisible rope and she pulls herself up the hill and she uses all these different things. Or I say, if there's anything going on for you, because she was getting bullied in school for a while, you know, use that, use the running to calm your mind and stuff. So the school often let her go out, and I got athletics brought into our school last year. And like sometimes she'd be upset or she'd be angry. Next of all, I look out the front door and she's at the putting the runners on, and we have a green and it's 200 metres on the path, and she'll literally go out and do 2K and lap and run around it and come back. I feel all right now, you know. So she's so disciplined and determined. But like, the main thing now is to keep her in it for the love of it, because there's a drop off with girls at a certain age. But it's great, because when I have runs on my plan, like if it's 5K, she can go out and do them with me, you know. So like, I think her 5K is 23 minutes, like, so pretty.
I'm trying to grow up my own ones. It's not as easy as that.
And then I seen, yeah, the twins had their little kids out running on the the race as well.
They're
like,
young.
Yeah.
They're 3 and 2, I think they are.
But like, she started off
at that age, around that age.
Yeah, doing a few 100 meters here and there. Like, it's sport. Nelson Mandela said that sport has the power of connection and the power to change people's lives. Like, and it does, because you see so many people now that have came from addiction. Like, I started a group called Hope Recovery Runners. Well, I didn't start. Irene did, and she got me in. And Hope Recovery Runners. And, like, all them girls are doing amazing. They're all working. And the women that never ran in their life went and done half marathons. And they continue to use that in their recovery, like.
Yeah.
So, like, it's actually, I don't know, your mind just feels free. It quietens my mind. Because, like, even still, your mind can get manic. Mine does. I think I'm ADHD because 3 of my kids are, like, So I definitely think, but it does, it quietens my mind. I just feel totally free, except when sometimes she's nagging at me when I'm running too slow for her. Like, it's a true story. Like,
isn't that a great complaint to have?
No, it is. But my thing in life is, like, some of the lads give me stick over my child being faster than me at shorter things. But that's my purpose in life, is to make her go far exceed what I have ever done and push her forward in life. Like, she writes her goals and she keeps saying, I'm going to be in the Olympics one day. And she's already says, like, I'm an Olympic runner. And it is, like, Ryan, how he believed that he would walk again. And he did. You know, it's what you put in your mind that will go on to making sure that you have that, like, you know, see it in your hands and it will appear, like.
Mm.
You know, I'm a firm believer in what you put out there comes back, like. And it does. I put so much good out there now. I didn't. I know I've definitely covered all the karma that I've done. Definitely, I've had to now at this stage. But so much good comes back to me, like.
Yeah.
And I love helping people. It's one of the things that I don't put all the work that I do up there.
Yeah. Rich, I'm a big advocate for penal reform. And this might be a hard question, but if you could fix one thing in the morning, what would it be? One change you could bring in the morning, no questions asked.
They put me on the spot there now.
She's saying, give me, how long's the list? Go one through thing, that whole list.
Just don't have prison.
Yeah.
No, I don't even know.
Mm.
It is a hard one because there's so much at the moment, like at the moment they're trying to push that people don't get sentences under 12 months, that community sanctions and, yeah, it would be that one, that community sanctions are put in place. So there is different community projects that instead of you going to prison for 12 months and having overcrowding that you're put into this program, if you don't go into this program, well then, after 12 months, well then you do your sentence if you're not engaging and you're not showing that you're changed. But definitely implement programs like that. Instead of sentencing people for like a month, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, because it's
not doing that.
No.
Yeah.
No.
I heard a little rumor as well. You're writing a book.
Yes, I am. Where did you hear that?
Where did you hear that?
Can't tell you.
Your ma told him.
Did she?
No.
She didn't even tell me.
No, it's that's a rumor.
Is that public knowledge? So you're allowed to say.
Yeah. And or that's why I don't share everything.
Because no one will buy the book then.
Yeah.
Oh, they will buy it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Opening the chapter. I know what happens there. Like,
there's a lot more to my life. Course. I could write a million books. And I tend to not speak on the same things, even when I go into the prisons. Like when I went into Clover Hill the other day, it was the impact of sport and fitness because a lot of them were doing the gym. But I wrote a few chapters and I've stopped. Because it brought a lot of stuff up and I went from early years and then I wrote a bit about in the now and a lot of memories that I thought didn't happen or that were blocked out came back. So I decided to step away from it for a little bit. So I write down every day just what happened in the day or different things. And I've all my prison letters still, so a lot of different stuff happened within the prison that I don't speak about either. Like there was many a time I was assaulted in there. Once while I was pregnant, like.
Have you anything that you want to plug? Anything that you want to mention?
Terence, do you know what they do with bananas in the prison?
Here we fucking go. Collect caterpillars or something.
No.
Go on.
Do you hear what they put them in the freezer for?
No.
I think I have an idea.
And they put rubber gloves on them.
Oh, holy.
I love how she asked you.
Why, yeah, why am I? I'm like, like, why am I?
You're getting more reserved.
Can
you figure out why they use them?
No. Why did she ask me that, man, to go and
blow? Because they're not getting matches of hair colour anyway.
Yeah.
I suppose if they're not getting days out like I was, what would they use them for?
Little visits.
Yeah.
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 They don't do them anymore.
Oh, listen, did they look use after yourself?
Yeah, years ago.
Did they, yeah?
Yeah. Maybe bring that back in.
There you go. The forced change.
What's that
contraception
called?
On TR. That's straight.
Make sure Ruth Barry gets a divorce from him.
Oh, geez.
Conjugal visits, that's called, yeah.
That's the word on that, is it?
Yeah.
Fuck me, man.
So, like, a lot of the work that we do is down to Spiranua. Damien Quinn and Michael McCusker in Turnaround Project. They have brought so many of us together and have been like our mentors and their colleagues of ours. And they just are doing such amazing work. And as I said, like, I'll always plug in our City Running Club because they've saved more lives than I think they realise. I've so many friends and they've welcomed me with open arms. And I've made so many connections that I also want to be able to eventually get women out of prison to do the race. I would love to do something like that. I just believe what they have developed is like a family and people need that connection. People need to see stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can buy me a book when it comes out. That's all I'd say.
You know the park run? You know the 5K park run?
I'm trying to get that in.
That's what I was going to say.
So they have it in the men's.
Yeah.
Would you ever go in?
We did it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. There was a fella up there doing a 5K in 18 minutes. I was like, who, Corum? How's he even in here? Do you know what I mean?
Do you know, I run with guards and I actually had that up on my story the other day. A guard that nicked me twice. Her name is Maeve. Hey, Maeve. She was cycling at the inner city run and she took videos of me little young one and I put up a thing. We actually got a picture with a few guards. They put it on the guard at Insta and I shared it and I was like, yeah. Yeah, I used to run from you and now you wouldn't catch me. But it's like, it's great that you have that relationship with them now. Do you know what I mean? That you can laugh and joke about these things and they're not serious and stuff like that. Now I have the guards seeking me to help with different stuff and bringing talks into schools about knife crimes like and stuff like that. So, you know, far cry from...
Full circle moment now, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's unbelievable.
So you're trying to get the 5K into the dog, you say?
So we spoke about it after the park or after the colour run. It would be 21 noobs that I would love to get that in for the women. When I seen the laughter and I seen the smiles and how much fun they had and the gift that running has gave me. Like it gave me connection to so many different clubs out there. Like not just in our city, just every one of them are amazing. Like they're unbelievable. Like, and I want that. And I want all those, the likes of them community-based running clubs to experience them women and be able to go in and give them that little bit of hope that running has gave so many of them. So I would love to get it in. I need to have a talk with the governor at the moment that's there. I did talk to her already. She's amazing. Lorraine, she's unbelievable. She's a very progressive governor.
Yeah.
And she's all about rehabilitation. And that's what the prison needs. They need the female governors. They need them that are supportive to families and reintegration and wanting to change and implement different programs within the prison. Like, so like, yeah, there's good things happening within there now. It's changed a lot since I've been in there. Still a lot similar.
Do change, yeah.
But with some of the staff in there, it's very progressive. And like, when you're working like that, it has to be empathy and compassion, and there has to be understanding. And a lot of the officers don't see the crime behind the person. They see a person that's broken, that's often at death's door. Some of the women use that as their safety blanket. They use it as a safe haven and they purposely commit the crime to get in there. Like
institutionalized.
Yeah, why should a woman feel safe in a prison?
Mm.
Like, what has society come to that a woman feels that she can get meals and a bed and feel safe in a prison that she can't outside? Her state has a lot to answer for, like, when it's not just women, it's men as well, that they feel safer inside because they haven't got a home to go to. They've nowhere to call their own. They get a hug off another prisoner that they might not get outside. They're near to listen and feel seen by an officer, or whether it's a therapist in there, or they feel more seen than they do out here. And that's just not acceptable. Like,
well, you're doing amazing work, Ruth.
Thank you.
Keep her up. I don't even know what else to say, what hasn't already been said.
Yeah, no, just look, a big thanks for coming in and sharing your story. Like, yeah, you said, it's not easy. You've done a lot of work on yourself.
Yeah.
It's amazing where you're at today from where you were. So, yeah, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for asking me to come in. I'm very grateful.
Thanks very much. Right, are we done?
Before we go, we just want to give a shout out to Roy Style Furniture for teaming up with the podcast.
Is your gaff overdue some TLC? Sort all at once with Roy Style Furniture. They've got proper quality stuff, sofas, beds, dining sets, and the house package deals are unreal value.
And you're supporting an Irish family-run business that actually knows what a good service looks like. Plus, they're in Font Hill, Belgard, and now the Omni Park store.
Open 7 days a week and late on Thursdays and Fridays in Font Hill and Omni. So there's no excuse. Get down and get the gaff sorted.
Right price, right style, right now. Visit www.roystyle.ie and use the promo code GET10 for 10% off.
How long? All right, thanks, Siobhan.
Boom.
Talking Bollocks, a Go Loud original podcast. Sponsored by Right Style Furniture. Right price, right style, right now. Visit rightstyle.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in it now. Fill your body again. Work it hard and long. When you finish that.
The Hypnotizer.